Jenny, Mother used to talk about the wee small hours. This was one of them. Beth kept playing chess, keeping 5 imaginary games going at once. She had forgotten about the pills in her pocket. The next morning, Mr. Ferguson handed her the little paper cup, as usual. But when she looked down into it, there were 2 orange vitamin tablets and nothing else. She looked back up at him, behind the little window of the pharmacy. "That's it," he said. "Next." She didn't move, even though the girl behind her was pushing against her. "Where are the green ones?" "You don't get them anymore," Mr. Ferguson said. Beth stood on tiptoe and looked over the counter. There, behind Mr. Ferguson, stood the big glass jar, still a third full of green pills. There must have been hundreds of them in there, like tiny jelly beans. "There they are," she said, and pointed. "We're getting rid of them," he said. "It's a new law. No more tranquilizers for kids."
"It's my turn," said Gladys, behind her.
Beth didn't move. She opened her mouth to speak, but nothing came out.
"It's my turn for vitamins," Gladys said, louder.
There had been nights when she was so involved in chess that she had slept without pills. But this wasn't one of them. She could not think about chess. There were 3 pills in her toothbrush holder, and that was it. Several times, she decided to take one of them, but then decided not to.
"I hear tell you're going to exhibit yourself," Jolene said. She giggled, more to herself than to Beth. "Going to play chess in front of people?"
"Who told you?" Beth said. They were in the locker room after volleyball. Jolene's breasts, not there a year before, jiggled under her gym shirt.
"Child, I just know things," Jolene said. "Ain't that where it's like checkers, but the pieces jump around crazy? My Uncle Hubert played that."
"Did Mrs. Deerdorf tell you?"
"Never go near that lady."
Jolene smiled confidently.
"It was Ferguson. He told me you'd go into the high school downtown, day after tomorrow."
Beth looked at her incredulously. The staff didn't trade confidences with the orphans.
"Ferguson?"
Jolene leaned over and spoke seriously.
"He and I have been friendly from time to time. Don't want you talking about it, hear?"
Beth nodded. Jolene pulled back and went on drying her hair with the white gym towel. After volleyball, you could always stretch out the time, showering and getting dressed before going to study hall. Beth thought of something. After a moment, she spoke in a low voice. "Jolene?"
"Uh-huh."
"Did Ferguson give you green pills? Extra ones?" Jolene looked at her hard. Then her face softened.
"No, honey. I wish he would. But they got the whole state after him for what they've been doing with those pills."
"They're still there, in the big jar."
"That a fact?" Jolene said. "I ain't noticed."
She kept looking at Beth.
"I noticed you've been edgy lately. You having withdrawal symptoms?"
Beth had used her last pill the night before.
"I don't know," she said. "You look around," Jolene said. "There'll be some nervous orphans around here the next few days."
She finished drying her hair and stretched. With the light coming from behind her, and with her frizzy hair and her big, wide eyes, Jolene was beautiful. Beth felt ugly, sitting there on the bench beside her, pale and little and ugly. And she was scared to go to bed tonight without pills. She had been sleeping only 2 or 3 hours a night for the past 2 nights. Her eyes felt gritty, and the back of her neck, even right after showering, was sweaty. She kept thinking about that big glass jar behind Ferguson, filled with green pills a third of the way up,
enough to fill her toothbrush holder 100 times. Going to the high school was her first ride in a car since she came to Methuen. That was 14 months ago, nearly 15. Mother had died in a car, a black one like this, with a sharp piece of the steering wheel in her eye. The woman with the clipboard had told her, while Beth stared at the mole on the woman's cheek and said nothing, had felt nothing either. Mother had passed on, the woman said. The funeral would be in 3 days. The coffin would be closed. Beth knew what a coffin was. Dracula slept in one. Daddy had passed on the year before because of a carefree life, as Mother put it. Beth sat in the back of the car with a big, embarrassed girl named Shirley. Shirley was in the chess club. Mr. Gans drove. There was a knot as tight as wire in Beth's stomach. She kept her knees pressed together and looked straight ahead at the back of Mr. Gans's neck and its striped collar, and at the cars and buses ahead of their car, moving back and forth outside the windshield. Shirley tried to make conversation.
Do you play the King's Gambit?
Beth nodded, but was afraid to speak. She hadn't slept at all the night before, and very little for nights before that. Last night she had heard Ferguson talking and laughing with the lady at reception. His heavy laughter had rolled down the corridor and under the doorway into the ward where she lay, stiff as steel, on her cot. But one thing had happened, something unexpected. As she was about to leave with Mr. Gans, Jolene came running up, gave Mr. Gans one of her sly looks, and said,
"Can we talk for just a second?"
Mr. Gans said it was okay, and Jolene took Beth hastily aside and handed her 3 green pills.
"Here, honey," she said. "I can tell you need these."
Then Jolene thanked Mr. Gans and skipped off to class, her geography book under one thin arm. But there was no chance to take the pills. Beth had them in her pocket right now, but she was afraid. Her mouth was dry. She knew she could pop them down, and probably no one would notice. But she was frightened. They would be there soon. Her head was spinning. The car stopped at a light. Across the intersection was a Pure Oil station with a big blue sign. Beth cleared her throat.
"I need to go to the bathroom."
"We'll be there in 10 minutes, Mr. Gans said.
Beth shook her head firmly.
"I can't wait."
Mr. Gans shrugged. When the light changed, he drove across the intersection and into the gas station. Beth went in the room marked Ladies and locked the door behind her. It was a filthy place, with smear marks on the white tiles and a chipped basin. She ran the cold water tap for a moment and put the pills in her mouth. Cupping her hand, she filled it with water and washed them down. Already, she felt better. It was a big classroom with 3 blackboards across the far wall. Printed in large capitals on the center board was, "Welcome Beth Harmon," in white chalk. And on the wall above this were color photographs of President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon. Most of the regular desks had been taken out of the living room and were lined along the hallway wall outside. The rest had been pushed together at the far end. 3 folding tables had been set up to make a U in the center of the room. And on each of these were 4 green and beige paper chessboards with plastic pieces. Metal chairs sat inside the U, facing the black pieces. But there were no chairs facing the white ones. It had been 20 minutes since the stop at the Pure Oil station, and she was no longer trembling. But her eyes smarted, and her joints felt sore. She was wearing her navy pleated skirt and a white blouse with red letters spelling Methuen over the pocket. There was no one in the room when they came in. Mr. Gans had unlocked the door with a key from his pocket. After a minute, a bell rang, and there were the sounds of footsteps and some shouts in the hallway, and students began to come in. They were mostly boys, Big boys, as big as men. This was senior high. They wore sweaters and slouched with their hands in their pockets. Beth wondered for a moment where she was supposed to sit. But she couldn't sit if she was going to play them all at once. She would have to walk from board to board to make the moves.
"Hey, Alan, watch out!"
one boy shouted to another, jerking his thumb toward Beth. Abruptly, she saw herself as a small, unimportant person, a plain brown-haired orphan girl in dull institutional clothes. She was half the size of these easy, insolent students, with their loud voices and bright sweaters. She felt powerless and silly. But then she looked at the boards again, with the pieces set in the familiar pattern, and the unpleasant feelings lessened. She might be out of place in this public high school, but she was not out of place with those 12 chessboards.
"Take your seats and be quiet, please,"
Mr. Gann spoke with surprising authority.
"Charles Levy will take board number one, since he's our top player. The rest can sit where they want to. There will be no talking during play."
Suddenly everyone was quiet, and they all began to look at Beth. She looked back at them, unblinking, and she felt rising in her a hatred as black as night. She turned to Mr. Gans. "Do I start now?" she asked.
"With board number one."
"And then I go to the next one?"
"That's right," he said.
She realized that he hadn't even introduced her to the class. She stepped over to the first board, the one with Charles Levy sitting behind the black pieces. She reached out, picked up the king's pawn, and moved it to the fourth rank. The surprising thing was how badly they played. All of them. In the very first games of her life, she had understood more than they did. They left backward pawns all over the place, and their pieces were wide open for forks. A few of them tried crude mating attacks. She brushed those aside like flies. She moved briskly from board to board, her stomach calm and her hands steady. At each board, it took only a second's glance to read the position and see what was called for. Her responses were quick, sure, and deadly. Charles Levy was supposed to be the best of them. She had his pieces tied up beyond help in a dozen moves. In six more, she mated him on the back rank with a knight-rook combination. Her mind was luminous, and her soul sang to her in the sweet moves of chess. The classroom smelled of chalk dust, and her shoes squeaked as she moved down the rows of players. The room was silent. She felt her own presence centered in it, small and solid and in command. Outside, birds sang, but she did not hear them. Inside, some of the students stared at her. Boys came in from the hallway and lined up along the back wall to watch the homely girl from the orphanage at the edge of town, who moved from player to player with the determined energy of a Caesar in the field, a Pavlova under the lights. There were about a dozen people watching. Some smirked and yawned, but others could feel the energy in the room, the presence of something that had never, in the long history of this tired old schoolroom, been felt there before. What she did was, at bottom, shockingly trivial, but the energy of her amazing mind crackled in the room for those who knew how to listen. Her chess moves blazed with it. By the end of an hour and a half, she had beaten them all without a single false or wasted move. She stopped and looked around her. Captured pieces sat in clusters beside each board. A few students were staring at her, but most avoided her eyes. There was scattered applause. She felt her cheeks flush. Something in her reached out desperately toward the boards, the dead positions on them. There was nothing left there now. She was just a little girl again, without power. Mr. Gans presented her with a 2-pound box of Whitman's chocolates and took her out to the car. Shirley got in without a word, careful not to touch against Beth in the back seat. They drove in silence, back to the Methuen home. 5 o'clock study hall was intolerable. She tried playing chess in her mind, but it seemed for once pale and meaningless after the afternoon at the high school. She tried reading geography, since there was a test the next day. But the big book was practically all pictures, and the pictures meant little to her. Jolene was not in the room, and she was desperate to see Jolene, to see if there were any more pills. Every now and then, she touched her blouse pocket with the palm of her hand in a kind of superstitious hope that she would feel the little hard surface of a pill. But there was nothing there. Jolene was at supper, eating her Italian spaghetti, when Beth came in and picked up her tray. She went over to Jolene's table before getting her food. There was another black girl with her, Samantha, a new one. Jolene and she were talking. Beth walked straight up to them and said to Jolene, "Have you got any more?" Jolene frowned and shook her head. Then she said, "How was the exhibit? You do okay?"
"Okay," Beth said. "Haven't you got just one?"
"Honey," Jolene said, turning away, "I don't want to hear about it." The Saturday afternoon movie in the library was The Robe. It had Victor Mature in it and was spiritual. All the staff was there, sitting attentive in a special row of chairs at the back, near the shuttering projector. Beth kept her eyes nearly shut during the first half hour. They were red and sore. She had not slept at all on Thursday night and had dozed off for only an hour or so Friday. Her stomach was knotted, and there was the vinegar taste in her throat. She slouched in her folding chair with her hand in her skirt pocket, feeling the screwdriver she had put there in the morning. Walking into the boys' woodworking shop after breakfast, she took it from a bench. No one saw her do it. Now she squeezed it in her hand until her fingers hurt, took a deep breath, stood up, and edged her way to the door. Mr. Ferguson was sitting there, proctoring.
"Bathroom," Beth whispered.
Mr. Ferguson nodded, his eyes on Victor Mature, bare-chested in the arena. She walked purposively down the narrow hallway, over the wavy places in the faded linoleum, past the girls' room and down to the multi-purpose room, with its Christian Endeavor magazines and Reader's Digest condensed books. And, against the far wall, the padlocked window that said, "Pharmacy." There were some small wooden stools in the room. She picked up one of them. There was no one around. She could hear gladiatorial shouts from the movie in the library, but nothing else except her footsteps. They sounded very loud. She set the stool in front of the window and climbed onto it. This put her face on a level with the hasp and padlock at the top. The window itself, made of frosted glass with chicken wire in it, was framed in wood. The wood had been thickly painted with white enamel. Beth examined the screws that held the painted hasp. There was paint in their slots. She frowned, and her heart began to beat faster. During the rare times when Daddy had been home, and sober, he had liked to do little jobs around the house. The house was an old one, in a poorer part of town, and there was heavy paint on the woodwork. Beth, 5 and 6 years old, had helped Daddy take the old switch plates and outlet plates off the walls with his big screwdriver. She was good at it, and Daddy praised her for it.
"You catch on real quick, sweetie pie," he said.
She had never been happier. But when there was paint in the screw slots, he would say,
"Let Daddy fix that for you,"
and would do something to get the screw head ready so that all she had to do was put the blade in the slot and turn. But what did he do to get that paint away? And which way should you turn the screwdriver? For a moment, she almost choked in a sudden flush of inadequacy. The shouts from the film arena rose to a roar, and the volume of the frenetic music rose with it. She could get down off the stool and go back and take her seat. But if she did that, she would go on feeling the way she felt now. She would have to lie in bed at night with the light from under the door in her face and the sounds from the corridor in her ears and the bad taste in her mouth, and there would be no relief, no ease in her body. She took the screwdriver handle and banged the two big screw heads with it. Nothing happened. She gritted her teeth and thought hard. Then she nodded grimly, took a fresh purchase on the screwdriver, and, using the corner of its blade, began to chisel out the paint. That was what Daddy had done. She pressed with both hands, keeping her feet firmly on the stool, and pushed along the slot. Some paint chipped loose, exposing the brass of the screw. She kept pushing with the sharp corner, and more came loose. Then a big flake of paint fell off, and the slot was exposed. She took the screwdriver in her right hand, put the blade carefully in the slot, and turned to the left, the way Daddy had taught her. She remembered it now. She was good at remembering. She twisted as hard as she could. Nothing happened. She took the screwdriver away from the slot, gripped it in both hands, and put the blade back in. Then she hunched her shoulders together and twisted until her hands felt sharp pains in them. And suddenly, something squeaked, and the screw loosened. She kept twisting until she could take it out the rest of the way with her finger and put it in her blouse pocket. Then she went to work on the other screw. The part of the hasp she was working on was supposed to be held by four screws, one at each corner. But only two had been put in. She had noticed this during the past several days, just as she had checked every day at vitamin time, to see if the green pills were still there in the big jar. She put the other screw in her pocket, and the end of the hasp came loose by itself, with the big padlock still hanging there, the other end supported by the screws that held it to the window frame. It had not taken her long to understand that you would have to remove only half a hasp, not both halves, the way it had looked at first. She pulled open the window, leaning back so it could go by her, and put her head inside. The light bulb was off, but she could see the outline of the big jar. She put her arms inside the opening and, standing on tiptoe, pushed herself as far forward as she could. That put her belly on the sill of the window. She began to wriggle, and her feet came away from the stool. There was a slightly sharp edge along the windowsill, and it felt as though it were cutting her. She ignored it and kept on wriggling, doing it methodically, inching forward. She both felt and heard her blouse ripping. She ignored it. She had another blouse in her locker and could change. Now her hands touched the cool, smooth surface of a metal table. That was the narrow white table Mr. Ferguson stood against when he gave them their medicine. She inched forward again, and her weight came down on her hands. There were some boxes there. She pushed them aside, clearing a space for herself. Now it was easier to move. She let her weight come forward with the sill under her hips until it scraped the tops of her legs, and she was able to let herself flop onto the table, twisting herself at the last second so she wouldn't fall off it. She was inside. She took a couple of deep breaths and climbed down. There was enough light for her to see all right. She walked over to the far wall of the tiny room and stopped, facing the dimly visible jar. It had a glass cover. She lifted this and set it silently on the table. Then she slowly reached inside with both hands. Her fingertips touched the smooth surface of tens of pills, hundreds of pills. She pushed her hands deeper, burying them up to the wrists. She breathed in deeply and held her breath for a long time. Finally, She let it out in a sigh and removed her right hand with a fistful of pills. She did not count them, simply put them in her mouth and swallowed until they had all gone down. Then she stuffed 3 handfuls of pills into her skirt pocket. On the wall to the right of the window was a Dixie cup dispenser. She was able to reach it by standing on tiptoe and stretching. She took 4 paper cups. She had decided on that number the night before. She carried them over, stacked, to the table that held the pill jar, set them down neatly, and filled them 1 at a time. Then she stood back and looked at the jar. The level had dropped to almost half what it had been. The problem seemed insoluble. She would have to wait and see what happened. Leaving the cups, she went to the door that Mr. Ferguson used when he went to do pharmacy duty. She would leave that way, unlocking it from the inside, and make 2 trips to carry the pills to the metal stand by her bed. She had a nearly empty Kleenex box to put them in. She would spread a few sheets of Kleenex on top and put the box in the bottom of her enameled nightstand, under her clean underwear and socks. But the door would not open. It was locked in some serious way. She examined the knob and latch, feeling carefully with her hands. There was a thick, heavy sensation at the back of her throat as she did this, and her arms were numb, like the arms of a dead person. What she had suspected when the door wouldn't open turned out to be true. You had to have a key, even from the inside. And she could not climb back out the little window carrying 4 Dixie cups full of tranquilizers. She grew frantic. They would miss her at the movie. Ferguson would be looking for her. The projector would break down and all the children would be sent into the multipurpose room with Ferguson monitoring them. And here she would be. But deeper than that, she felt trapped. The same wretched, heart-stopping sensation she had felt when she was taken from home and put in this institution and made to sleep in a ward with 20 strangers and hear noises all night long that were, in a way, as bad as the shouting at home when Daddy and Mother were there. The shouting from the brightly lit kitchen. Beth had slept in the dining room on a folding cot. She felt trapped then, too, and her arms were numb. There was a big space under the door that separated dining room from kitchen. The light had streamed in under it, along with the shouted words. She gripped the doorknob and stood still for a long moment, breathing shallowly. Then her heart began beating almost normally again, and feeling came back into her arms and hands. She could always get out by climbing through the window. She had a pocket full of pills. She could set the Dixie cups on the white table inside the window, and then, when she was back on the stool outside, she could reach in and take them out, 1 at a time. She could visualize it all, like a chess position. She carried the cups over to the table. She had begun to sense in herself an enormous calm, like the calm she had felt that day at the high school when she knew she was unbeatable. When she set down the 4th cup, she turned and looked back at the glass jar. Ferguson would know that pills had been stolen. That could not be hidden. Sometimes her father had said, "In for a dime, in for a dollar." She took the jar over to the table and poured the contents of the Dixie cups back into it, stepped back, and checked. It would be simple to lean over from the outside and lift the jar out. She knew, too, where she could hide it, on the shelf of a disused janitor's closet in the girls' room. There was an old galvanized bucket up there that was never used. The jar would fit into it. There was also a short ladder in the closet, and she could use it safely, because a person could lock the door on the girls' room from the inside. Then, if there was a search for the missing pills, even if they found them, they couldn't be traced to her. She would take only a few at a time and wouldn't tell anyone, not even Jolene. The pills she had gulped down a few minutes before were beginning to reach her mind. All of her nervousness had vanished. With clear purposefulness, she climbed up on Mr. Ferguson's white table, put her head out the window, and looked around her at the still empty room. The jar of pills was a few inches from her left knee. She wriggled her way through the window and onto the stool. Standing up high there, she felt calm, powerful, in charge of her life. She leaned forward dreamily and took the jar by its rim in both hands. A fine relaxation had spread through her body. She let herself go limp, staring down into the depths of green pills. Stately music came from the movie in the library. Her toes were still on the stool, and her body was loosely jackknifed over the window ledge. She no longer felt the sharp edge. She was like a limp rag doll. As her eyes lost focus, the green became a bright, luminous blur.
"Elizabeth?"
The voice seemed to come from a place inside her head.
"Elizabeth!"
She blinked. It was a woman's voice, harsh, like mother's. She did not look around. Her fingers and thumbs on the side of the jar had gone loose. She squeezed them together and picked up the jar. She felt herself moving in slow motion, like slow motion in a movie, where someone falls from a horse at a rodeo, and you see him float gently to the ground, as though it could not hurt at all. She lifted the jar with both hands and turned, and the bottom of the jar hit the window ledge with a dull ringing sound, and her wrists twisted, and the jar came loose from her hands and exploded on the edge of the stool at her feet. The fragments, mixed with hundreds of green pellets, cascaded to the linoleum floor. Bits of glass caught light like rhinestones and lay in place shivering while the green pills rolled outward like a bright waterfall toward Mrs. Deerdorf. Mrs. Deerdorf was standing a few feet away from her saying,
"Elizabeth!"
over and over again. After what seemed a long time, the pills stopped moving. Behind Mrs. Deerdorf was Mr. Ferguson, in his white pants and t-shirt. Next to him stood Mr. Shell. And just behind them, crowding to see what had happened, were the other children, some of them still blinking from the movie that had just ended. Every person in the room was staring at her, high on the miniature stage of her stool, with her hands a foot apart, as though she were still holding the glass jar. Ferguson rode with her in the brown staff car and carried her into the hospital, to the little room where the lights were bright and they made her swallow a gray rubber tube. It was easy. Nothing mattered. She could still see the green mound of pills in the jar. There were strange things happening inside her, but it didn't matter. She fell asleep and woke only for a moment when someone pushed a hypodermic needle in her arm. She did not know how long she was there, but she did not spend the night. Ferguson drove her back the same evening. She sat in the front seat now, awake and unworried. The hospital was on the campus where Ferguson was a graduate student. He pointed out the psychology building as they drove past it.
"That's where I go to school," he said.
She merely nodded. She pictured Ferguson as a student, taking true-false tests and holding his hand up when he wanted to leave the room. She had never liked him before, had thought of him as just one of the others.
"Jesus, kid," he said. "I thought Deerdorf would explode."
She watched the trees go by outside the car window.
"How many did you take? 20?
"I didn't count."
He laughed. "Enjoy 'em," he said. "It'll be cold turkey tomorrow."
At Methuen, she went directly to bed and slept deeply for 12 hours. In the morning, after breakfast, Ferguson, once again his usual distant self, told her to go to Mrs. Deerdorf's office. Surprisingly, she wasn't afraid. The pills had worn off, but she felt rested and calm. While getting dressed, she had made an extraordinary discovery. Deep in the pocket of her serge skirt, survivors of her being caught, her trip to the hospital, her undressing and then dressing again, were 23 tranquilizers. She had to take her toothbrush out of its holder to get them all in. Mrs. Deerdorf kept her waiting almost an hour. Beth didn't care. She read in National Geographic about a tribe of Indians who lived in the holes of cliffs. Brown people with black hair and bad teeth. In the pictures, there were children everywhere, often snuggled up against the older people. It was all strange. She had never been touched very much by older people, except for punishment. She did not let herself think about Mrs. Deerdorf's razor strop. If Deerdorf was going to use it, she could take it. Somehow she sensed that what she had been caught doing was of a magnitude beyond usual punishment. And deeper than that, she was aware of the complicity of the orphanage that had fed her and all the others on pills that would make them less restless, easier to deal with. Mrs. Deerdorf did not invite her to sit. Mr. Shell was seated on Mrs. Deerdorf's little blue chintz sofa, and in the red armchair sat Miss Lonsdale. Miss Lonsdale was in charge of chapel. Before she had started slipping off to play chess on Sundays, Beth had listened to some of Miss Lonsdale's chapel talks. They were about Christian service and about how bad dancing and communism were, as well as some other things Miss Lonsdale was not specific about. "We have been discussing your case for the past hour, Elizabeth," Mrs. Deerdorf said. Her eyes, fixed on Beth, were cold and dangerous. Beth watched her and said nothing. She felt something was going on that was like chess. In chess, you did not let on what your next move would be. "Your behavior has come as a profound shock to all of us. Nothing." For a moment, the muscles at the sides of Deerdorf's jaw stood out like steel cables. "Nothing in the history of the Methuen home has been so deplorable. It must not happen again." Mr. Shell spoke up. "We are terribly disappointed."
"I can't sleep without the pills," Beth said.
There was a startled silence. No one had expected her to speak. Then Mrs. Deerdorf said, "All the more reason why you should not have them." But there was something odd in her voice, as though she were frightened.
"You shouldn't have given them to us in the first place," Beth said.
"I will not have back talk from a child," Mrs. Deerdorf said.
She stood up and leaned across the desk toward Beth.
"If you speak to me like that again, you will regret it."
The breath caught in Beth's throat. Mrs. Deerdorf's body seemed enormous. Beth drew back, as though she had touched something white hot. Mrs. Deerdorf sat down and adjusted her glasses.
"Your library and playground privileges have been suspended. You will not attend the Saturday movies, and you will be in bed promptly at 8 o'clock in the evenings. Do you understand?"
Beth nodded.
"Answer me."
"Yes."
"You will be in chapel 30 minutes early, and will be responsible for setting up the chairs. If you are in any way remiss in this, Miss Lonsdale has been instructed to report to me. If you are seen whispering to another child in chapel or in any class, you will automatically be given 10 demerits.
Mrs. Deerdorf paused.
"You understand the meaning of 10 demerits, Elizabeth?"
Beth nodded.
"Answer me."
"Yes."
"Elizabeth, Miss Lonsdale informs me that you have often left chapel for long periods. That will end. You will remain in chapel for the full 90 minutes on Sundays. You will write a summary of each Sunday's talk and have it on my desk by Monday morning."
Mrs. Deerdorf leaned back in the wooden desk chair and folded her hands across her lap.
"And Elizabeth?"
Beth
looked at her carefully.
Yes, ma'am.
Mrs. Deerdorf smiled grimly.
No more chess.
The next morning, Beth went to the vitamin line after breakfast. She could see that the hasp had been replaced on the window, and that this time there were screws in all four of the holes at each side of the padlock. When she came up to the window, Ferguson looked at her and grinned.
"Want to help yourself?" he said.
She shook her head and held her hand out for the vitamin pills. He handed them to her and said,
"Take it easy, Harmon."
His voice was pleasant. She had never heard him speak that way at vitamin time before. Miss Lonsdale wasn't too bad. She seemed embarrassed at having Beth report to her at 9:30, and she showed her nervously how to unfold and set out the chairs, helping her with the first two rows of them. Beth was able to handle it easily enough. But listening to Miss Lonsdale talk about godless communism and the way it was spreading to the United States was pretty bad. Beth was sleepy, and she hadn't had time to finish breakfast. But she had to pay attention so she could write her report. She listened to Miss Lonsdale talk on in her deadly serious way about how we all had to be careful, that communism was like a disease and could infect you. It wasn't clear to Beth what communism was. Something wicked people believed in other countries, like being Nazis and torturing Jews by the millions. If Mrs. Deerdorf hadn't told him, Mr. Scheibel would be expecting her. She wanted to be there, to play chess, to try the King's Gambit against him. Maybe Mr. Gans would be back with someone from the chess club for her to play. She let herself think of this only for a moment, and her heart seemed to fill. She wanted to run. She felt her eyes smarting. She blinked and shook her head and went on listening to Miss Lonsdale, who was talking now about Russia, a terrible place to be.
"You should have saw yourself," Jolene said. "Up on that stool, just floating around up there and Deerdorf hollering at you."
It felt funny.
"Shit, I bet it felt good."
Jolene leaned a little closer.
"How many of them downers you take anyhow?"
30. Jolene stared at her.
"Shit,"
she said. It was difficult to sleep without the pills, but not impossible. Beth saved the few she had for emergencies and decided that if she had to stay awake for several hours every night, she would spend the time learning the Sicilian defense. There were 57 printed pages on the Sicilian in modern chess openings, with 170 different lines stemming from PQB4. She would memorize and play through them all in her mind at night. When that was done, and she knew all the variations, she could go on to the Perk and the Nimzovich and the Ruy Lopez. Modern Chess Openings was a thick, dense book. She would be all right. Leaving geography class one day, she saw Mr. Scheibel at the end of the long hallway. He had a metal bucket on wheels with him and was mopping. The students were all going the other way, to the door that led to the yard for recess. She walked down to him, stopping where the floor was wet. She stood for about a minute, until he looked up at her. "I'm sorry," she said. "They won't let me play anymore."
He frowned and nodded, but said nothing.
"I'm being punished. I..." She looked at his face. It registered nothing. "I wish I could play more with you."
He looked for a moment as if he was going to speak, but instead he turned his eyes to the floor, bent his fat body slightly, and went back to mopping. Beth could suddenly taste something sour in her mouth. She turned and walked back down the hall. Jolene said there were always adoptions around Christmas. The year after they stopped Beth from playing chess, there were two in early December. Both pretty ones, Beth thought to herself.
Both white, Jolene said aloud.
The two beds stayed empty for a while. Then one morning before breakfast, Ferguson came into the girls' ward. Some of the girls giggled to see him there with the heavy bunch of keys at his belt. He came up to Beth, who was putting on her socks. It was near her 10th birthday. She got her second sock on and looked up at him. He frowned.
We got a new place for you, Harmon. Follow me.
She went with him across the ward, over to the far wall. One of the empty beds was there, under the window. It was a bit larger than the others and had more space around it.
You can put your things in the nightstand, Ferguson said.
He looked at her for a minute.
It'll be nicer over here.
She stood there, amazed. It was the best bed in the ward. Ferguson was making a note on a clipboard. She reached out and touched his forearm with her fingertips, where the dark hairs grew above his wristwatch. Thank you, she said.
3.
I see that you will be 13 in 2 months, Elizabeth, Mrs. Deardorff said.
Yes, ma'am. Beth was seated in the straight-backed chair in front of Mrs. Deardorff's desk. Ferguson had come and taken her from study hall. It was 11 in the morning. She had not been in this office for over 3 years. The lady on the sofa suddenly spoke up, with strained cheerfulness.
12 is such a wonderful age, she said.
The lady wore a blue cardigan over a silky dress. She would have been pretty, except for all the rouge and lipstick, and for the nervous way she worked her mouth when she talked. The man sitting next to her wore a gray salt-and-pepper tweed suit with a vest.
Elizabeth has performed well in all of her schoolwork, Mrs. Deardorff went on. She is at the top of her class in reading and arithmetic.
That's so nice, the lady said. I was such a scatterbrain at arithmetic.
She smiled at Beth brightly.
I'm Mrs. Wheatley, she added in a confidential tone.
The man cleared his throat and said nothing. He looked as if he wanted to be somewhere else. Beth nodded at the lady's remark, but could think of nothing to say. Why had they brought her here? Mrs. Deardorff went on about Beth's schoolwork while the lady in the blue cardigan paid rapt attention. Mrs. Deardorff said nothing about the green pills or about Beth's chess playing. Her voice seemed filled with a distant approval of Beth. When she had finished, there was an embarrassed silence for a while. Then the man cleared his throat again, shifted his weight uneasily, and looked toward Beth as though he were looking over the top of her head.
Do they call you Elizabeth?
He sounded as if there were a bubble of air in his throat.
Or is it Betty?
She looked at him. Beth, she said. I'm called Beth. During the next few weeks, she forgot about the visit in Mrs. Deardorff's office and absorbed herself in schoolwork and in reading. She had found a set of girls' books and was reading through them whenever she had a chance, in study halls, at night in bed, on Sunday afternoons. They were about the adventures of the oldest daughter in a big, haphazard family. 6 months before, Methuen had gotten a TV set for the lounge, and it was played for an hour every evening. But Beth found that she preferred Ellen Forbes's adventures to I Love Lucy and Gunsmoke. She would sit up in bed, alone in the dormitory, and read until lights out. No one bothered her. One evening in mid-September, she was alone reading when Ferguson came in.
"Shouldn't you be packing?"
he asked. She closed her book, using her thumb to keep her place.
"Why?" "They haven't told you."
"Told me what?"
"You've been adopted. You're being picked up after breakfast."
She just sat there on the edge of the bed, staring at Ferguson's broad white T-shirt.
"Jolene,"
she said. I can't find my book.
What book?
Jolene said sleepily. It was just before lights out. Modern chess openings, with a red cover. I keep it in my nightstand. Jolene shook her head. Beats the shit out of me. Beth hadn't looked at the book for weeks, but she clearly remembered putting it at the bottom of the second drawer. She had a brown nylon valise beside her on the bed. It was packed with her three dresses and four sets of underwear, her toothbrush, comb, a bar of Dial soap, two barrettes, and some plain cotton handkerchiefs. Her nightstand was now completely empty. She had looked in the library for her book, but it wasn't there. There was nowhere else to look. She had not played a game of chess in 3 years, except in her mind. But modern chess openings was the only thing she owned that she cared about. She squinted at Jolene. You didn't see it, did you? Jolene looked angry for a moment. Watch who you go accusing, she said. I got no use for a book like that. Then her voice softened. I hear you're leaving. That's right. Jolene laughed. What's the matter? Don't want to go? I don't know. Jolene slipped under the bedsheet and pulled it up over her shoulders. Just say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, and you'll do all right. Tell them you're grateful to have a Christian home like theirs, and maybe they'll give you a TV in your room. There was something odd about the way Jolene was talking. Jolene? Beth said. I'm sorry. Sorry about what? I'm sorry you didn't get adopted. Jolene snorted. Shit, she said. I make out fine right here. She rolled over away from Beth and curled up in bed. Beth started to reach out toward her. But just then, Miss Firth stepped in the doorway and said, Lights out, girls! Beth went back to her bed for the last time. The next day, Mrs. Deerdorf went with them out to the parking lot and stood by the car while Mr. Wheatley got into the driver's seat and Mrs. Wheatley and Beth got into the back. Be a good girl, Elizabeth, Mrs. Deerdorf said. Beth nodded, and as she did so, saw that someone was standing behind Mrs. Deerdorf on the porch of the administration building. It was Mr. Scheibel. He had his hands stuffed in his coverall pockets and was looking toward the car. She wanted to get out and go over to him. But Mrs. Deerdorf was in the way, so she leaned back in her seat. Mrs. Wheatley began talking, and Mr. Wheatley started the car. As they pulled out, Beth twisted around in her seat and waved out the back window at him. But he made no response. She could not tell for sure if he had seen her or not.
You should have seen their faces, Mrs. Wheatley said. She was wearing the same blue cardigan, but this time she had a faded gray dress under it, and her nylons were rolled down to her ankles. They looked in all my closets and even inspected the refrigerator. I could see immediately that they were impressed with my provisions. Have some more of the tuna casserole. I certainly enjoy watching a young child eat.
Beth put a little more on her plate. The problem was that it was too salty, but she hadn't said anything about that. It was her first meal at the Wheatleys. Mr. Wheatley had already left for Denver on business and would be away for several weeks. A photograph of him sat on the upright piano by the heavily draped dining room window. In the living room, the TV was playing unattended. A deep male voice was declaiming about Aniston. Mr. Wheatley had driven them to Lexington in silence and then gone immediately upstairs. He came down after a few minutes with a suitcase, kissed Mrs. Wheatley distractedly on the cheek, nodded a goodbye to Beth, and left. They wanted to know everything about us. How much money Alston makes a month, why we have no children of our own. They even inquired. Mrs. Wheatley bent forward over the Pyrex dish and spoke in a stage whisper.
They even inquired if I had been in psychiatric care.
She leaned back and let out her breath.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
No, ma'am, Beth said, filling the sudden silence. She took another forkful of tuna and followed it with a drink of water.
They are thorough, Mrs. Wheatley said. But you know, I suppose they have to be.
She had not touched anything on her plate. During the 2 hours since they arrived, Mrs. Wheatley had spent the time jumping up from whatever chair she was sitting in and going to check the oven or adjust one of the Rosa Bonheur prints on the walls or empty her ashtray. She chattered almost constantly, while Beth put in an occasional, "Yes, ma'am," or "No, ma'am." Beth had not yet been shown her room. Her brown nylon bag still sat by the front door, next to the overflowing magazine rack, where she had left it at 10:30 that morning.
God knows, Mrs. Wheatley was saying. God knows they have to be meticulous about whom they turn their charges over to. You can't have scoundrels taking the responsibility for a growing child.
Beth set her fork down carefully. May I go to the bathroom, please?
Why, certainly.
She pointed to the living room with her fork. Mrs. Wheatley had been holding the fork all during lunch, even though she had eaten nothing.
The white door to the left of the sofa.
Beth got up, squeezed past the piano that practically filled the small dining room, and went into the living room, and through its clutter of coffee table and lamp tables and huge rosewood TV, now showing an afternoon drama. She walked carefully across the Orion shag carpet and into the bathroom. The bathroom was tiny and completely done in robin's egg blue, the same shade as Mrs. Wheatley's cardigan. It had a blue carpet and little blue guest towels and a blue toilet seat. Even the toilet paper was blue. Beth lifted the toilet seat, vomited the tuna fish into the bowl, and flushed it. When they got to the top of the stairs, Mrs. Wheatley rested for a moment, leaning her hip against the banister and breathing heavily. Then she took a few steps along the carpeted hallway and dramatically pushed a door open.
This, she said, will be your room.
Since it was a small house, Beth had visualized something tiny for herself. But when she walked in, she caught her breath. It looked enormous to her. The floor was bare and painted gray, with a pink oval rug at the side of the double bed. She had never had a room of her own before. She stood, holding her valise, and looked around her. There was a dresser and a desk whose orange-looking wood matched it, with a pink glass lamp on it and a pink chenille bedspread on the enormous bed.
You have no idea how difficult it is to find good maple furniture, Mrs. Wheatley was saying. But I think I did very well, if I do say so myself.
Beth hardly heard her. This room was hers. She looked at the heavily painted white door. There was a key in it, under the knob. She could lock the door and no one could come in. Mrs. Wheatley showed her where the bathroom was down the hall, and then left her alone to unpack, closing the door behind her. Beth set down her bag and walked around, stopping only briefly to look out each of the windows at the tree-lined street below. There was a closet, bigger than Mother's had been, and a nightstand by the bed, with a little reading lamp. It was a beautiful room. If only Jolene could see it. For a moment, she felt like crying for Jolene. She wanted Jolene to be there, going around the room with her while they looked at all the furniture, and then hung Beth's clothes in the closet. In the car, Mrs. Wheatley had said how glad they were to have an older child. Then why not adopt Jolene? Beth had thought. But she said nothing. She looked at Mr. Wheatley with his grim set jaw and his two pale hands on the steering wheel, and then at Mrs. Wheatley. And she knew they would never have adopted Jolene.
Beth sat on the bed and shook off the memory. It was a wonderfully soft bed, and it smelled clean and fresh. She bent over and pulled off her shoes and lay back, stretching out on its great, comforting expanse, turning her head happily to look over at the tightly closed door that gave her this room entirely to herself. She lay awake for several hours that night, not wanting to go to sleep right away. There was a street light outside her windows, but they had good heavy shades that she could pull down to block it out. Before saying goodnight, Mrs. Wheatley had shown Beth her own room. It was on the other side of the hall, and exactly the same size as Beth's. But it had a television set in it, and chairs with slipcovers, and a blue coverlet on the bed. "It's really a remodeled attic," Mrs. Wheatley said. Lying in bed, Beth could hear the distant sound of Mrs. Wheatley coughing, and later she heard her bare feet padding down the hallway to the bathroom. But she didn't mind. Her own door was closed and locked. No one could push it open and let the light fall on her face. Mrs. Wheatley was alone in her own room, and there would be no sounds of talking or quarreling, only music and low synthetic voices from the television set. It would be wonderful to have Jolene there, but then she wouldn't have the room to herself, wouldn't be able to lie alone in this huge bed, stretched out in the middle of it, having the cool sheets, and now the silence, to herself. On Monday, she went to school. Mrs. Wheatley took her in a taxi, even though it was less than a mile. Beth went into seventh grade. It was a lot like the public high school in that other town where she had done the chess exhibition, and she knew her clothes weren't right, but no one paid much attention to her. A few of the other students stared for a minute when the teacher introduced her to the class. But that was it. She was given books and assigned to a homeroom. From the books and what the teacher said in class, she knew it would be easy. She recoiled a bit at the loud noises in the hallways between classes and felt self-conscious a few times when other students looked at her. But it was not difficult. She felt she could deal with anything that might come up in this sunny, noisy public school. At lunchtime, she tried to sit alone in the cafeteria with her ham sandwich and carton of milk. But another girl came and sat across from her. Neither of them spoke for a while. The other girl was plain, like Beth. When she had finished half her sandwich, Beth looked across the table at her. "Is there a school chess club?" she asked. The other girl looked up, startled. "What? Do they have a chess club? I want to join." "Oh," the girl said. "I don't think they have anything like that. You can try out for junior cheerleader." Beth finished her sandwich. "You certainly spend a lot of time at your studies," Mrs. Wheatley said. "Don't you have any hobbies?" Actually, Beth was not studying. She was reading a novel from the school library. She was sitting in the armchair in her room by the window. Mrs. Wheatley had knocked and then come in, wearing a pink chenille bathrobe and pink satin slippers. She walked over and sat on the edge of Beth's bed, smiling at her distractedly, as though she were thinking about something else. Beth had lived with her a week now, and she noticed that Mrs. Wheatley was often that way. "I used to play chess," Beth said. Mrs. Wheatley blinked. "Chess? I like it a lot." Mrs. Wheatley shook her head as though shaking something out of her hair. "Oh, chess," she said. "The royal game. How nice." "Do you play?" Beth said. "Oh, Lord, no," Mrs. Wheatley said with a self-deprecating laugh. "I haven't the mind for it, but my father used to play. My father was a surgeon and quite refined in his ways."